Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Counting down the hours to a big Obamacare deadline, the new reality of the auto recall, and what the government is doing in an old mine in western Pennsylvania. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's the last day of March, and thanks for being with us. We got a new report today from the United Nations on climate change. As you might expect, it's not all sunshine and roses. Researchers say climate change is already affecting many parts of the world. Sea levels are rising, there are more heat waves. And the report's conclusion is now is the time for us to adapt, to make changes. But politics aside, adapting for the future climate can be really tricky. That's Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
We, us people, do okay handling risks we know about. We adapt to them, try to avoid them. Ben Orlove is a co-director of the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions at Columbia University.
We do a pretty good job of preparing for some infectious diseases with getting children vaccinated, and we put strong housing codes into effect in earthquake-prone areas.
We're less good at preparing for threats we've never seen, like climate change.
It's hard for us to accept risks that are uncertain and that are far in the future.
The uncertainty, the future nature of many climate change impacts, means making hard decisions about adaptation, about who should adapt, who should pay to adapt, how we use water and resources and land, even harder. Dan Mazmanian is a professor at USC's Sol Price School of Public Policy.
How are you going to make all these decisions when you can't tell them exactly what level the sea rise is going to affect them in 2030, 2040, 2050?
The best strategy for moving ahead, he thinks, is what he calls
adaptive management for adaptation.
Adapting and then adapting for the way we adapt. Many climate models look out to a future that's too far away for us to imagine. Instead, we ought to be thinking a few decades out, he says, and then rethinking the rules again and again as the science and future gets clearer. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
It's the last day of the month, April Fool's Day Eve, and deadline day for the Affordable Care Act. A lot of people, a couple million, logged on this weekend and today, trying to beat the midnight deadline to enroll. Not without a few problems along the way. I'm joined by Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein from our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Hey, David. Great to talk to you, too.
So I read this morning there was trouble with the website. This afternoon there was more trouble with the website. I was on Twitter before I came in here. It sounds like there are a lot of people who have had trouble signing up for health insurance today.
Yeah, you know, and it's not just Twitter, David. I was in downtown Philadelphia today at the headquarters of Independence Blue Cross, and some phone calls aren't going through. You know, going on to healthcare.gov, you're getting some error messages. I spoke with company executive Paula Sunshine, and she said to me, functionality is spotty.
I don't think anybody is surprised by the amount of volume that we're seeing today and, you know, just the challenges that we're going to have. I think we were as prepared for it as we could be. I think the federal government has also anticipated that this might be the case.
So what she's saying there, David, when she said that this might be the case is basically, while today is officially the last day of enrollment, it is not totally the last day. There's some Americans who are going to be able to enroll after this. But I think really the policy interest is what's driving this, which says the federal government believes that some technical glitch should not get in the way of somebody trying to sign up for insurance. So if you can make a good faith effort to try to get insurance, you should be entitled to do that. And so people will have till the middle of April. And if they are able to, in fact, enroll, then that coverage will start May 1st.
So as you mentioned, the focus there has been on how many people have signed up, how many people have been able to sign up, how many people haven't been able to sign up. And at this point here, as we face this deadline, I wonder, what do we know about that? What do we know about who's signed up and who hasn't?
What we know is that it's going to be north of 6 million people for sure, which is going to exceed sort of the most recent expectations. What we don't know is how many uninsured people are part of that. There's some estimates out there, but they're rough.
So once we hit this deadline, it seems to me the focus shifts to the fall, which is when enrollment starts up again. I just wonder sort of what you're looking at as a reporter. Where do we go from here?
Right. Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that everybody is sort of wondering about is What are the insurers going to do? The insurers basically, to set the rates in 2014, the insurers were sort of making a bet, anticipating we're going to have this many sick people, we're going to have this many healthy people. And based on that anticipation, based on that formula, they set the rates. And now we're going to see in the next couple of weeks how close that bet was. Were they on the money or were they off the money? And if they were really off, then that could mean we're going to see a real increase in the premiums that we pay. So that's one question. I think another question, though, that actually has not gotten a lot of attention has been, are consumers going to be happy with this product that they're buying? If consumers aren't happy here, David, at the end of the day, and they don't decide to re-up in 2015, that's going to be a real problem long term. That's one of the really important questions, I think, over the next couple of months.
Dan Gorenstein from Marketplace's Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, David.
On Wall Street today, Fed Chair Janet Yellen gave the markets a little boost. Details on that when we do the numbers. More bad news today for General Motors CEO Mary Barra. The automaker is recalling more than 1 million vehicles, this time for power steering problems. Barra will be on Capitol Hill tomorrow and Wednesday testifying before Congress. Lawmakers want to know how much GM knew about another GM recall focusing on ignition switch problems. Those have been linked to more than a dozen deaths, and they've led to the recall of some 2.6 million vehicles. As Marketplace's Kate Davidson reports, when it comes to the economics of recalls, they're a bit like preventative medicine. Better to catch them early than late.
When you buy a car, some of that money goes into a reserve to cover warranty claims and recalls. Auto analyst Marianne Keller says the frequency of recalls has increased in recent years. 2013 had a bumper crop.
Last year, there were 22 million cars recalled.
In 632 different recall campaigns. Sometimes cars are recalled for serious safety issues like GM's, and sometimes not so much.
There have been recalls where 2 pages of an owner's manual were replaced because after the fact they discovered that some wording was incorrect.
That's how strong a company's fear of liability can be. But that kind of recall, the 2 pages genre, gets a pretty low response rate. Keller says GM's current recall is going to cost a lot, thanks to 2.6 million cars and a ton of publicity. Now, recalls in and of themselves aren't necessarily a bad thing. John Odell is a senior editor with Edmunds.com.
What are some of the most trusted names in the car business today? You know, Toyota, Honda.
He says these companies have some of the highest recall rates per car sold. He says recalls can have an economic benefit.
And the reason is because it helps build a lot of trust between the automaker, the dealer who's handling the actual, you know, interface, and the car shopper.
My automaker's got my back is the message, he says. It's the message GM CEO Mary Barra will try to convey to Congress and the world this week. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Hunger is a huge problem in India, a country with more than 1 billion people. But about 11% of Indians are now overweight. As part of our collaboration with the BBC on obesity, the BBC's Rahul Tandon reports from Calcutta.
I'm inside one of Calcutta's largest malls. I'm in the food court. It is full of youngsters, and they're all here not to eat Indian food, but to eat fast food. There's burgers, there's pizzas, there's fried chicken. You get it all here.
We like to have it.
It's tasty. That's why we love it. We love to have it. Kids love these foods. Now nothing is healthy.
I've left the mall and I'm walking on the busy streets of Calcutta. This is a city where people love to eat. It's famous for its sweets and also its street food. I've come here to meet Sean Kenworthy. He was born in Manchester, but he's now this city's most famous chef. So we're standing outside one of the Chinese stalls here, which are very popular, Indian Chinese. Just describe, you know, some of the food that you get in there.
So again, it's a modern-day Asian thing, I think, really. People are almost surviving on deep-fried snacks. So you have things like chicken lollipops on the menu here, you know, chicken fried rice.
And it's part of the culture for mothers to feed their kids, yeah. Constantly.
Constantly.
All the time.
And every 2 or 3 hours there'll be some food, and you're expected to eat. Come on, bring it down a bit more. Exhale up.
Preetam Mukherjee Roy splits his time between trying to get people fitter and telling them what to eat. He's a nutritionist. He was trained in America. He works with lots of children and says the problem is that fast food has now become cool here in India.
The bread that they use for the buns, everything is higher sodium, oil, sugar. Basically, soft drinks abroad, it's about 16 to 18 teaspoons of sugar, whereas over here, the same soft drinks would have about 22 to 23 spoons.
Okay, can I order a...
I've come back to the food court at the mall, still very busy here, lots of children, many of them overweight. Most of them are from India's upper middle class. They have lots of money from their cash-rich parents, which they come and spend here.
All the youths of Calcutta assemble here to have fun, to chat, to eat.
Do you worry about the food? A lot of people say Western fast food is really bad for you.
We like eating Western fast food.
You don't think that what you have in your hand is bad for you?
I don't think.
Like, I have it every day, so I'm not going to like change the way it is.
If you don't have fast food every day, how do you feel?
I feel like crying, actually. Like, it's very depressing.
Every day, the food court here gets busier and busier. This is the contradiction of India. Whilst the people around me are getting fatter and fatter, in other parts of this country, most people are still struggling to get two decent meals a day. In Calcutta, I'm the BBC's Rahul Tandon for Marketplace.
And you can hear more of our series on obesity at marketplace.org. Coming up,
he's the guy who came up with the idea of cutting ice off New England lakes, packing it on ships, and sending as far away as India.
Our series, I've Always Wondered, this time about the business of ice. The cold, hard facts in just a sec, but first, let's do the numbers. The stock markets closed the quarter on an up note as Federal Reserve head Janet Yellen reassured investors that interest rates will stay low. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up 134 points, 0.8%, to close at 16,457. The Nasdaq gained 43 points, 1%, finishing at 4,198. And the S&P 500 added 14 points, 0.8%, ending at 1,872. In a battle over heart valves, Medtronic gained 1.8% after a study said its artificial heart valve, which is inserted through an artery, has a lower mortality rate than open heart surgery. Another study said Edwards Lifesciences' artificial heart valve is easier to insert, and Edwards expanded 4%. European markets fell, bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.72%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday, April 1st, also known as April Fool's Day. Make a note to yourself so you remember. Was there a lot of traffic on car lots last month? Automakers are slated to report sales. 38 years ago, Apple was founded. And April is National Decorating Month. So feng shui your cube, living room, or man cave. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal, and I'm usually one of Marketplace's Washington reporters, based in D.C., of course, and that makes me very familiar with jokes about the absurdity of bureaucracy. The federal government is big, it's Byzantine, and that can always be exaggerated to comedic effect. Well, sometimes no exaggeration is needed, which brings us to an old limestone mine beneath the ground in Pennsylvania, in which hundreds of federal employees toil day in and day out. And the weird thing is, they're not miners. It's their office. David Farenthold is a staff writer for The Washington Post, and he's written a piece about what those employees are up to and why they're down there. Hey, David.
Hello.
Start off, if you would, just by describing this room, this subterranean complex.
Well, the first thing to talk about is its location. It's not anywhere near Washington. It's about an hour north of Pittsburgh.
In the middle of nowhere, really, right?
Absolutely in the middle of nowhere. The nearest town is Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania. So that gives you a sense. When Slippery Rock is the urban area, you're talking about a pretty rural place. And so you drive along through sort of country roads out in the middle of nowhere, just forests around you, and then you get to a giant parking lot. And then at the side of that giant parking lot is a long road into the ground. So you go down through a security gate and into the earth, and then you're 22 stories under the ground.
So it's remote, it's isolated, it's underground. You would think that what's happening in this place is something top secret or something that the government wants to keep prying eyes out of. What actually happens in this cave?
What happens there is the processing of federal employees' retirement papers.
That's very innocuous.
Yeah, it's the height of mundaneness, right? These are people who've worked for the government for 30 years or longer, and when they put in their money, put in their papers to retire, they want to start getting their pension. This is where they handle that paperwork. As you go along in your career, they're responsible for collecting records on you as you shift from one federal agency to the other. They have retirees from the moment they retire until they die, and in some cases until their descendants die. The reason it's in a mine is not for secrecy, but because they need that much space. They have 28,000 file cabinets, five-drawer file cabinets, full of paper. And that gives you a sense of how big this paper-based operation is.
Why has it been so hard to modernize these operations and perhaps even to move these operations out of the cave back into daylight, maybe into Washington, D.C.?
Well, the thing that was interesting to me was, you know, I'd read a lot of the coverage of healthcare.gov and seen a lot of the descriptions of why that IT project failed. And I was surprised to see, looking back at the history of this place, because there's been three big attempts to modernize it just since the 80s. And every one of them ran into the same kind of problems we had with healthcare.gov, which is they spent a bunch of money and nobody until the very end was sure that what they were paying for was going to work. In 2008, for instance, they spent over $100 million on this multi-year effort to automate it. And then lo and behold, when they turned it on and February 2008, it broke. And after a few months, they end up having to turn the whole thing off and go back to paper with all that money basically lost.
Is it somehow more complicated to enter this type of data into the system?
It's complicated. For instance, when we talk to people about why it takes so long to key in an individual case, they say there's all kinds of questions like, were you ever a cafeteria worker at the U.S. Capitol? Were you ever a prison guard? Were you ever a federal firefighter? Did you work part-time? Were you a postal worker? All those categories have sort of separate little rules governing them. And so there can be dozens, even more than, you know, hundreds of little separate calculations, wheels within wheels, that you have to manage just to get one case done. Now, computers are made to do complicated tasks. So it's, to me, impossible to imagine that Congress, as good as it is at writing complicated laws, has written a law so complicated that a computer couldn't handle it.
David Farenthold is a staff writer for The Washington Post, author of The Sinkhole of Bureaucracy. Thanks very much, David.
Thank you.
So we got this question the other day from a guy named John Cox, just a loyal Marketplace listener like yourself. He listens to the show on WPNE in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Those big silver ice boxes that we see outside of gas stations and sometimes in grocery stores all over the country, where do they come from? What's the deal? They seem to be everywhere.
So today on our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder.
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade.
The business behind those boxes of ice. KNPR's John Sepulveda reports from Las Vegas, and he says it all starts with one guy.
Hey, can I get some old-timey music right here? Okay, thank you. I'm about to take you back to the 1800s to meet this guy named Frederick Tudor.
Frederick Tudor was the ice king of New England in the early 19th century.
That's Jonathan Reese. He's a history professor at Colorado State University Pueblo, and he wrote a book called Refrigeration Nation. He says in the early 1800s, Tudor had a crazy idea.
He's the guy who came up with the idea of cutting ice off New England lakes, packing it on ships, and sending as far away as India. Turns out, if you did that, you could still keep 50 to 75% of the ice you packed there.
Tudor knew how to move ice. He shipped some 200 tons of ice overseas. But it was his U.S. push that would ultimately pay off. He traveled the country getting folks to try ice and convincing bartenders and shop owners how good it would be for their businesses.
He was very successful and started an entire new industry and got Americans really hooked on ice.
And here's the part about the boxes. People had to find a way to make it last, or really They're just investing in puddles of water, right? So there was a box with a little insulation, a little ventilation, and a drain. And these boxes were, of course, put outside, which is what...
Most ice boxes are actually kept in the basement.
Wait, what?
And at least in the early days, 1840s, 1850s. But when you got to about the 1890s, particularly the high-end ice boxes are more effective. They're made of porcelain, and you can bring those up to the kitchen.
Oh, yeah, up to the kitchen. That's what I was going to say, because households kept their boxes inside, but walk-up ice vendors kept their operations outside. That's because by the 1900s, vendors kept food on ice as well. And if that box happened to melt, things got really gross.
It does stink sometimes.
Reese says these ice boxes helped Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Florida attract people around the turn of the century.
Nevada, to the gold rushes of 49, was a state of extreme horror. It was a hot, pale piece of an unearthly blot on the surface of the universe. And where none, by choice, should ever tread.
And they even spawned other businesses, like 7-Eleven. That store started out as an ice box in Texas in the early 1900s, run by a guy who worked for an ice company. Funny enough, in Las Vegas, most 7-Elevens don't have ice boxes outside. Their rival, though, Circle K, does. I went to get some ice at a Circle K down the street from where I live. It was a windy day, and I walked up to the box and I swung it open. I opened the box is locked. This is not convenient. So I go in, talk to the clerk, a woman named Patty Clifton, and she takes me to the back cooler where the ice is kept and tells me ice is in big demand here in the desert. They lock them up to prevent theft.
There's people coming in here all the time stealing whatever they want. And ice, I mean, it's middle of the summertime. They want ice. They're going to take ice.
Clifton says it's insane, those are her words, that they sell ice in the first place. It's just water, she says. These days, refrigeration has replaced pickaxes, and the average American buys just 4 bags of ice a year, almost all of it between Memorial Day and Labor Day. But there are still big bucks to be had from businesses. Kent Johns owns a Las Vegas bar called Atomic Liquors. He says every now and then his ice machine goes on the fritz, and when it does, he counts on those big white boxes.
You know, we have to get, I mean, like 30, 40 bags to accommodate the type of business we do down here at the Atomic.
Sales like this add up to an industry that nets nearly $2.5 billion in ice sales a year. And when you think of it, that's a lot of product to leave out in front of a gas station. I'm John Sepulvedo for Marketplace.
We want to know what you've always wondered about the world of business and commerce. Go to marketplace.org and click on I've Always Wondered to ask your own question. Here's something I quite honestly thought I'd never say. Michael Jackson is coming out with a new album. It's called Escape. It'll be released on May 13th, and it'll be available to pre-order tomorrow on iTunes. You know, it's not just the album. Basically, anything Michael Jackson is making money these days. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith looks at how the king of pop has remained such a stellar earner.
Our cultural love affair with Michael Jackson is clearly far from over. Jackson has a 10-album deal worth around $250 million, a lucrative ad partnership with Sony, and a Cirque du Soleil show in Vegas. The King of Pop passed away nearly 5 years ago, but Michael Jackson, Inc. hasn't missed a beat. The year after his death, the Jackson estate reportedly took in $1 billion. Larry Miller is a professor of music business at the NYU Steinhardt School.
He was a once-in-a-generation songwriter and recording artist. And at the moment, he's firing on all cylinders.
Miller says Jackson's estate owns the rights to a lot of Beatles songs and part of Sony's music publishing business. DVD sales from his film This Is It have brought in millions, not to mention Jackson's own catalog, which took in more than $25 million last year. Also, when Michael Jackson died, a lot of expenses disappeared, says Gary Bongiovanni, editor-in-chief of Polestar magazine.
He was living well beyond his means. Even though he was making an enormous amount of money, he spent more than he took in.
And with an iconic artist like Jackson, his work, published and unpublished, has a rare legacy and lasting quality, says entertainment industry analyst Toby Miller.
I think when you're talking about major talents that has global exposure, there's really no limit to the life that goes on after theirs has been taken.
Miller points to artists like Jimi Hendrix, Buddy Holly, and Elvis, all of whom made millions post-mortem. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which your car will have something called a rear view visibility system, otherwise known as a video camera, that actually helps you see behind you as you're backing up. It's safer, and it'll keep you from straining your neck when you're parallel parking. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration will begin phasing the cameras in to 2016 models, and it estimates that between 58 to 69 lives will be saved each year. The cost per vehicle, by the way, is about $130, though the agency estimates most automakers will already have put in cameras way before the deadline because of consumer demand. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 134 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ added 43 points, 1%. The S&P 500 rose 14 points, 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Melissa Yeager-Miller, and Millie Jefferson. I'm David Gura. Hope you can join us tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.